This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Education as a Force for Social Change. This is Lecture 9, entitled The Social Basis of Public Education, given in Stuttgart, May 18, 1919. I do not intend to continue last Sunday's discussion in the normal way. Then I did my best in a preliminary sketch to present how to think about culture and teaching independent of the life of the state and the economy. I tried to show that if there is such a separation, teachers would need to use the various subjects to form a kind of anthropological pedagogy, or perhaps I should say a kind of anthropological teaching. I then noted that a significant goal for the future is to change the education and certification of teachers so that we can determine whether a given person is suitable for teaching. I want to set aside further discussion of pedagogical questions until a later time. Today I want to try to continue my main topic in a very different way. I want to show you how I think we need to speak today to serve the needs of our time when we present impulses of modern development at education conferences or such. If we wish to move out of confusion and chaos in the present, we really must speak very differently about things than people imagine. At teachers' conferences, as I can show you through some examples, people speak in the old, time-tested manner. We can achieve a truly free education for the future only when teachers are raised to that level where they have an overview of the great tasks of the present time and their consequences for the educational system. Certainly, I do not present the way I am speaking as being necessary or even exemplary. I want only to indicate the direction in which to speak to modern teachers to inspire them to work toward a free education. They must come to understand the great and comprehensive tasks of the present. Teachers must have insight into the forces hidden in modern history. They must know of the impulses arising out of the past that we must now end. They must understand the impulses arising from modern life that require particular care and attention. We must provide, in the best sense, we might say the most ideal sense, a socio-political standpoint that can form the basis of the inspiration teachers need. People must understand, for example, that our current pedagogy is, at all levels of education, completely bankrupt, and they must see the reasons for this. Modern pedagogy has lost its direct connection with life. Today, pedagogues speak about all kinds of methodological questions and of the benefits of allowing the state to direct education. They would probably speak of such benefits almost automatically, even if they had a theoretical understanding of the necessity of the threefold social organism. At no other time have self-perpetuating thinking habits been as strong as in the present. These habits are particularly evident in the development of pedagogical ideas. Pedagogical ideas have suffered under something we cannot escape in modern times, but must, in fact, escape. There are questions today that we can no longer answer with the reply that, quote, judging from experience, this or that may be possible, unquote. In such cases, hesitation arises in human hearts and souls. Today we must answer numerous questions with the question, if we want to escape our present confusion and chaos, does not this or that have to occur? Here we are dealing with a question of will and need not allow the often justifiable intellectual hesitation based on so-called experience. Experience has value only after the will has properly processed it. Experience abounds today, but the will has properly processed only a little of it. From a strictly intellectual perspective, we can say little against much that people say in the field of pedagogy today, and it is actually quite wise from this perspective. Today, though, it is important to see the real problem, namely that our pedagogy has become divorced from life. Allow me to make a personal remark here. About 23 years ago, a society for college education was formed in Berlin. The head of this society was the astronomer Wilhelm Förster, and I also belonged to it. We held a series of lectures for the society. Most of these lectures would lead you to believe that you need know only certain formal things about the treatment of the different sciences, or the composition of the different faculties, or similar things. I attempted, but without much success, to make clear that a college only represents a cross-section of general life. I said that if we want to speak about college pedagogy, we must begin with the questions, where do the various areas of study lie in relation to life in general? What impulses from the various realms of life do we need to observe so that real life will enter the college and make the college representative of life in general? If you do not think about such things abstractly, but instead look at them concretely, then you can see many ways to view things, such as limiting the amount of time devoted to one or another subject, or how we can approach one or another subject. The moment modern pedagogy attempts to look at such limitations, everything fails, and colleges become nothing other than places to drill people divorced from the world. What are the intrinsic reasons, the deep inner reasons, why everything has become the way it is? The magnificent recent development of scientific thinking has led to a comprehension of the human being as a strictly natural being, at the same time cutting off any true understanding of humanity, that understanding of humanity that we recently spoke of as being the essential basis of real pedagogy. Scientific thinking has cut us off from that understanding of humanity through which we can recognize living human beings and the totality of their existence, not simply in the formal way of today, but in recognition of the true inner essence of human existence, namely human development. This tremendously anti-human attitude of modern pedagogy has a symptom I have often mentioned here. When we say such things today, people may accuse us of a paradox. However, we must say them because of their importance. The loss of a truly living understanding of humanity has led to a hopeless and desolate area of experimental psychology. I have nothing against experimental psychology per se, namely intelligence tests, a horror story of contemporary education. I have often said that psychologists experimentally test human memory and even intellect to determine by quote-unquote objective means whether someone has a good or bad memory, or is intelligent or not. In this purely mechanical procedure, psychologists give sentences that the person being tested must complete, or other such things. In this way, they attempt to create a picture of the capabilities of developing human beings. This is a symptom of how our society has lost everything productive in the direct relationships between people. Intelligence testing is a symptom of the rising modern desolation that people see as especially progressive and arises from psychological research in modern universities. People can never comprehend what it means to create a pedagogy full of life and able to achieve truly free minds, unless they understand that we must return to an intuitive understanding of human nature, received directly from the human being, from the developing human being. They can never comprehend this living education unless they are able to overcome the cleft that exists between one person and another. To make something of pedagogy, we must sweep all this experimenting on people out of our schools. Experimental psychology can be a valuable basis of psychology, but when it sneaks into pedagogy and even into the courtrooms, it ruins everything that requires healthy development, that needs fully developed people, not separated by a gulf from other fully developed people. We have brought things so far that we have excluded everything human from our society's goals. We must change this to again include the human element. We must have the courage to energetically put a stop to much of the quote-unquote progress that has slowly built up in recent times. Otherwise, we will never get any further. So often today, those students who leave the colleges to become teachers leave filled with the most upside-down views about human beings. They do not receive real views because such superficial ideas as experimental tests of intelligence have replaced those views. We must recognize this as a symptom of decay. We must seek in ourselves the ability to determine another's capacities because others are human beings as we ourselves are. We must see that all other methods are ill-fated because they are devoid of the direct living comprehension of the human element so necessary if we are to move forward in a healthy way. Modern people do not see these things at all, but they are very important if we are to move forward. How often we have spoken of these things. You have often smiled about some of these idiocies, but you have not always understood the reason for speaking of them and why they have become a part of our modern thinking. Today it is not important that you hear these things the way you would read a feature article in the newspaper, that you learn to differentiate between witty remarks or observations and thoughts that contain a seed for action is important. All anthroposophic activity culminates in creating an idea of human beings and providing an understanding of human beings. We need that. We need it because our times demand that we overcome a threefold predicament. Three tyrannies remain from the past. First, the oldest tyranny, masked in various ways at present, is the priestly tyranny. We would progress further in our consideration of the present situation if we could recognize that this masquerade no longer exists in conjunction with facts, but unfortunately still exists in human thinking about government and about the impulses arising in Europe, America, and Asia. This is the modern disguise of the ancient priestly tyranny. The second oppression arose somewhat later in human historical development, namely political tyrannies, which now occur in various forms. The third thing came relatively recently, and that is economic tyranny. Humanity must work itself out of these three tyrannical inclinations. That is its immediate task. This will be possible only when we see where the residues of these different masks live in us today, these three tyrannies existing in humanity. Today it is important to raise educators' views to the level where we can discuss such things, and where we can bring the light we receive from such understanding to current events. Educators' views must be at the level where we can see how this or that compulsion everywhere hides behind various facts of the present time. However, we must now have the courage to say that because pedagogy has distanced itself from the real world, in a sense has withdrawn into the schools, it has come to the point of generating such twisted ideas. The experimental testing of human capabilities is only one symptom of this. We can see the result of the state forcing pedagogy to withdraw into the schools and to distance itself from life wherever modern people speak of general or special education methods. At present, I am expressly saying at present, and particularly in our region of the world, we cannot fully develop the principal realms of life, namely the cultural, the rights or political, and the economic realms, unless we set them upon their own feet. It is somewhat different for us than for the extreme West, that is, America, and the extreme East, but just because it is different for us, it is so important that we realize this fact. We must ultimately come to think concretely and not abstractly, otherwise we will arrive at a theory that delights humanity throughout the world and is nonsense, or in historical development at a kind of thousand-year Reich that is just as much nonsense. Thinking concretely in this area means to think for a specific part of the world and a specific time. We will have more to say about that later today. Educators must direct their attention toward these major world events. They must see what exists in modern cultural life and what they must change to educate children much differently than the way they themselves were drilled. What we have recently cultivated has led to a horrible specialization in the field of education and in teachers. In lectures and at scientific or academic gatherings, we often hear songs of praise for specialization. If I could not see the reasons for academic specialization, I would, of course, be irresponsible. However, we need to balance this specialization, because otherwise we will build walls between people, and we would no longer meet other human beings with understanding. We would face one another helplessly as one specialist confronting another, and would have nothing upon which to base our trust in a specialist other than the fact that he or she has been officially certified in some way or another. Through the schools, we are now on the path of bringing this specialization into daily life. It remains to be seen whether the present-day confusion will protect us from the affliction, suggested by many, of having psychologists, along with all the other courtroom specialists, perform their experiments on the accused, as they do now on young people. I am not so very opposed to these things in themselves, but I oppose the way they have slipped into modern life. This is how things are in pedagogy, in the schools, and in government. After the short time when people spoke of inherent human rights, or as they called them, natural rights, it does not matter whether these were contestable or not, the age came when people were embarrassed to discuss these rights. People called anyone who spoke of natural rights a dilettante. They called anyone who thought rights were connected with the existence of human beings as individuals a dilettante. Professionally, people could speak only of historical rights, that is, what had historically developed as a right. People lacked the courage to recognize true rights, and therefore limited themselves to a discussion of historical rights. Educators today must be particularly aware of this. In their professional conferences, educators must learn of the 19th century developments and how we lost the concept of natural rights, or, at best, allowed it to live on only in a disguised form. They must understand people's persistent wavering and inner doubt in the face of what is merely historical. If you understand the situation, you know that the prevailing trend still moves toward historical rights, only we no longer notice its extreme forms when it sneaks into pedagogy. To use Goethe's words, people take pains not to speak of inherent rights. They avoid speaking of such rights at all costs. In my lectures here, I have often noted that now we must openly and honestly enter the day of reckoning and put it off no longer. For this reason, we can no longer shy away from clearly stating that we need to eliminate since we can never rebuild human habits of thinking and feeling unless we have a clear idea of what ruined them. In our Middle European society, we can easily see how a genuinely positive idea of government collapsed. At the beginning of the 19th century, people's attempts to create a positive government failed, because historical forces replaced it with an impulse of their own. Those active in these efforts believed they worked within the boundaries of unprejudiced research, but the result was one that served only the ends of the state or the economy. The state influenced not only the administration of research, but also the content of research, particularly applied research. We have virtually no national economic policy today, because free and independent thinking could not develop. Therefore, people today understand nothing when we speak of true economic laws. We see this especially in the chaotic educational system. Education done in a grand style, remote from real life, and withdrawn into the schoolroom. If we point out only what we should experience and not how we should experience it, a living consideration of something can never occur. The only thing we have developed in recent times is the worship of superficial experience, and that leads only to confusion, particularly when we carry it out with exactitude. We need to learn to cultivate the inner disposition that leads us toward a proper view of experience. You may recall that last Friday I drew your attention, though only briefly due to the limitations of these lectures, to the way we can gain insight into the form needed for economic cooperatives by studying late 14th and early 15th century European economics. We must create the social cooperation of the future from today's urge for production and consumption. If we ground our thorough consideration of the facts in anthroposophy, then we arrive at the basic viewpoint that the foundation of all European life lies in the events of the dawn of modern times, at the end of the 14th and the beginning of the 15th centuries. In this way, we do not falsify facts, but they guide us to those points of development whose important symptoms reveal what normally remains hidden beneath the surface, and is now seen to be their driving principle. Without that insight, the inherent characteristics of the scientific method remain hidden from modern pedagogy and objective thinking. Pedagogy and research depended more or less upon chance to draw their attention to this or that area. We need inner guidance that directs us to the important truths. We can gain these guidelines from Goethe's worldview, and they allow us to recognize a great deal. We cannot fabricate them or simply seek them in the intellect. We must seek them in the picture of how human beings are interwoven with the world, and in how we have totally lost sight of this. We can see how much we have lost sight of this fact in that we so superficially want to fathom individual human beings through their pedagogical diversion, experimental psychology. Let me read that again. We can see how much we have lost sight of this fact in that we so superficially want to fathom individual human beings through that pedagogical diversion, experimental psychology. Above all, children's teachers must gain insight about the core of modern development. If we now stand at a point where we must change the main direction of life, it is most important that we comprehend what has previously occurred in human development. First to go under was a basic impulse toward a governmental life free of economics. Then, beginning in the last third of the 19th century, particularly in Middle Europe, we trod upon our cultural life and, frankly, made it into a parasite. How much has entered our modern cultural life of the great impulses of Goetheanism, for example? Nothing. Virtually nothing. People speak superficially about Goethe, but nothing of the tremendous things in Goethe's way of seeing the world has entered general consciousness. I have often mentioned that the leadership of the Goethe Society in Weimar found it impossible to think of putting someone at the head of the society who understood something of Goethe. They could accept only a washed-up Prussian finance minister. I also mentioned that we could easily smile at this choice, since his first name is Double-Cross Yourself, Kreuz Wende Dich. In this way, we have sailed into a position of discounting our cultural heritage. Nowhere in our modern consciousness can we find an imprint of Goethe's viewpoint upon German cultural life. We have eliminated all of that, thus turning cultural life into a parasite. Edition after edition of Goethe has been published, but nowhere has Goethe's spirit been absorbed. If you can see through such things, you must admit that today things are terrible in the realm of economics, things are terrible in the realm of politics, but in the cultural realm, things are the worst. First, we ruined our political consciousness, then our connection to our own cultural life. I do not say this to be pessimistic, but because what we must do must arise out of an insight into what has occurred. Then came what people call the World War. After the collapse of political life, which people continued to prop up, and the inner collapse of cultural life came the economic collapse. People today have no idea of the magnitude of this, because they believe we are at the end or possibly the middle of this collapse. We are actually only at the beginning. You can study this economic collapse. Everywhere you see what has become a world catastrophe. If you objectively study what occurred with the so-called Baghdad Railway affair before the war, then you will see the most unfortunate interconnections between political and economic life. If you follow the individual stages of the Baghdad Railway negotiations, particularly those connected with the unfortunate Mr. Helfrich, then you can see, on the one hand, the formation of one capitalistic cartel after another, and on the other, the influence of national political chauvinistic intrigues. These intrigues were different depending upon whether they arose in the East or in the West. In Germany, we see the loss of conscious activity because we had lost cultural life and political life. We limited everything to economic life. From the West, economic and political aspirations played in everywhere, carrying the disguise of chauvinism or nationalism or economic policy. From the East, cultural policies played in, disguised in various manners. All of this came together in a ball of confusion that then resulted in the absurdity of the Baghdad affair. The Baghdad Railway affair and the entire sequence of events provide proof of the impossibility of further developing the old imperialism, that is, the impossibility of further developing the old political system. What we could see in a major world political problem, namely in the will to construct this railway, we could also see in individual instances during the war. People have simply never considered things so that factual guidelines could bring them to the point where external events reveal their inner connections. Here you have it. Kapp shrieked, Bethmann, Hollweg whined, and the cultural representatives of Germany were silent. This was the situation. Kapp, the representative of agriculture, shrieked because he didn't know which way to turn between the problems of the war economy and the problems of agriculture. Bethmann Hollweg, who had no head for politics, whined because he didn't know how to say anything reasonable about the situation. The cultural leaders of Germany remained silent because they had completely withdrawn into academic ivory towers and knew nothing of life or how to handle things in life. I do not know how many of you remember this affair. I haven't exaggerated anything at all. It really was the situation that Kapp shrieked and Bethmann Hollweg whined in the Reichstag about the terrible way he, the poor man, had been treated. Those who should have known something about such things were quiet or only spoke about things distant from life. Only a conspicuous absurdity could have demonstrated the nature of economic progress. Many people never have noticed how we have slid regarding the government. They had their Hohenzollerns, their Habsburgs, their Romanov czars. People could delude themselves about the fact that the seed of destruction lay within czarism, or the Hohenzollerns dynasty, or the Habsburg dynasty, because the artificial framework held together what was already moving toward dissolution, because government ideals no longer existed. Modern socialists often emphasize that the state must cease to exist, but no one has done more to cause the cessation of reasonable government than the European dynasties of the 19th century. Through illusions and self-deception, we could deceive ourselves about the fact that we beat cultural life into the ground during the 19th century, but concerning economic life, that is not possible. When the state is starving, it consoles itself with festivities and brings paper flowers to dynasties. It is no fairy tale, but in fact provable that, to have them as souvenirs, well-dressed women fell upon the cigarette butts Wilhelm II threw away on the Hamburg bridges. It is also not a fairy tale that the selfsame Wilhelm II did not turn away in disgust from such goings-on, but in his pomposity saw them as positive. He was, in fact, delighted by them. In the economic area, we have experienced such unusual events that we cannot characterize them other than to say that agriculture squealed, politics whined, and industry rubbed its stomach because it felt so good. At first, the workers, at least while they still received some crumbs from industry, also rubbed their stomachs until they went to the front and learned a different tune. Then they spread other viewpoints when they returned home. Anyone who claims that the collapse began at home is clearly lying. The collapse actually began at the front lines because people could no longer bear the situation. Today, teachers in particular must know such things. They can no longer sit in a quiet corner and know nothing of life. Instead, they must know what we must do. Today, instead of discussing formalities at their conferences, it is more important that the teachers of our youth speak openly about these historical events and bring to light what we can so clearly show in the area of capitalist economics. You are certainly aware that one side claims and the other denies a sentence attributed to a particular society, namely, the end justifies the means. Under the influence of capitalism, a quite different impulse has become apparent in economic life during this world catastrophe, namely, the end condemns the means. Everywhere you look, you can see this, specifically, from the Baghdad railway problem. The means invalidate the goals, or, on the other hand, the goals invalidate the means. We must be aware of such things, and we must pursue them relentlessly. Insofar as I have directed my remarks today toward pedagogy, I believe that we must speak to teachers at every level in this way. Perhaps not in the way I am speaking, but at least from this direction. We must outgrow what has until now kept teachers at various levels from being told of great world events, causing our present experience of the absolute political naivete of a large segment of the population. Now you meet people who have not the faintest idea of what the proletarian movement has been doing for decades, not even its most superficial activities. I cannot be polite about this, since I cannot even say present company excluded, at least not all. Such people do not have the slightest idea how the proletariat has struggled for decades. An education that sends people out into the world so that they simply pass one another by and know nothing of one another inevitably leads to a collapse. Are there not middle-class people today who know virtually nothing more about the workers than that they dress differently, who know nothing of the striving that lives in the unions and political parties, and who make no effort whatsoever to really look at what is going on around them? Why is this? Because people never learned how to learn from life. They only learned how to know this or that. People think to themselves, I know this, and I am a specialist in this area. You know that. You are a specialist in that area. People have accustomed themselves to this kind of thinking. They have never gone further than the knowledge absorbed in school and consider the absorption of such knowledge as the ideal. However, what is truly important is that people learn to learn, that they learn to learn so they can remain a student of life even when they become old, right until death. Today, people, even if they have graduated from a college, generally stop learning after they reach their 20s. They can no longer learn from life. They only drone on and on about what they have learned until then. At best, they occasionally add something. Those who are different are the exception today. It is important that we find a way to teach how to learn, that is, how to learn throughout life from life. We can always learn something from life. We would be in a quite different situation today if people had learned to learn. Why are we so socially helpless today? Because people are not equal to the events of today. They cannot learn from events because they always cling to appearances. In the future, education will not bear fruit if we do not make the effort to raise ourselves to the higher viewpoints of human society. Anyone who looks at today's world with just a little anthroposophic background will know how to think concretely about current events. People can look to the West and to the East and derive tasks from specific observations. Looking to the West and to the Anglo-American world, We can see the great political impulses that have been so detrimental to us here in Middle Europe, but have played such a large role in the last decades, perhaps longer. All those major impulses that have entered modern political life began with the Anglo-American peoples, because they have always known how to take historical forces into account. During the war, when I tried to tell people that we could counter the forces that arise in the West only with similar forces derived from historical impulses, they laughed at me, because they did not believe in the great historical impulses. If you study the Anglo-American West, you will find there a number of human instincts and tendencies arising from historical life. All these inclinations have a political, economic nature. There are important basic tendencies within the Anglo-American culture, all of which have a political, economic color, so that those people think of economics politically. However, there is something peculiar about this. You know that when we speak about economics, we demand that fraternity rule economy in the future. However, just this fraternity was forced out of the Western imperialistic political economic movement. Fraternity was left out, it was shut out. And for this reason, what is alive there has a strongly capitalistic character. Fraternity developed in the East. If you study the East in connection with its entire spiritual and soul aspects, then you will see that a sense of fraternity pours out of people there. What was so unusual in the West was the flood of economic life under an anti-social influence, an economic life that thus tends toward capitalism. In the East we find fraternity without economics. We, in Middle Europe, held these two tendencies apart. One of the important things teachers must know is that we have the task of creating a synthesis of the East's sense of fraternity with the West's antisocial economic thinking. If we can do this, we will achieve socialization in the larger sense. Let us now look at the East from the proper perspective. We find there, even in ancient times, a highly developed spiritual life. And only someone who does not understand Rabindranath Tagore could claim that it is now dead. There, people live a spiritual political life. That is in the East. Where is its opposite? That is, again, in the West. Something is missing from the spiritual political life of the East, namely freedom. In the East, a kind of subjugation exists, which leads to the renunciation of the human self in Brahma or Nirvana. This is the contradiction of all freedom. The West, on the other hand, has mastered freedom. We stand in the middle and must form a synthesis. We can do this if we clearly separate freedom and fraternity in life and have the balance to do so. We must not understand our task as imagining that what is good for one is good for everyone, since thinking so abstractly would be the ruin of all genuine desire. People destroy all thinking consistent with reality when they believe they can set up some worldwide, unified, abstract ideal, or wish to determine a modern social organization valid for all time. This is not only nonsense, but also a sin against reality, because every area and every time has its own tasks, and we must recognize them. We cannot be so lazy as not to look at the realities of specific human relationships. And we must recognize as our task that we learn to study facts in their proper perspective. Modern public education has brought us even further away from a proper interpretation of events. It has no desire to know anything about concrete, specific events, since modern people begin to feel so uncertain just here. Today, people want to define rather than characterize. They want to accept only superficial events, rather than to see events as symptoms of the underlying impulses. I am speaking today such that all I have to say can be drawn from the way we must now speak about pedagogy. Today, the best teachers are those who can properly understand what comes from this direction, and not those who can tell us only what they know about this or that subject. Anyone can gain knowledge of a particular subject by reading a handbook or encyclopedia while preparing for a class. In the future, teaching examinations must answer the question, of how people are as people. When applied to pedagogy, this kind of cultural life requires that we do not prepare people in an unbalanced manner for their work, but that we prepare them to actually apply spiritual activity to all three aspects of human nature. I certainly do not suggest that those who have never lifted a hammer can never see truth properly and can never stand in cultural life properly. We can achieve this by having people move about in the three areas of the social organism, having them make real connections with all three areas, and working, truly working, in all three. Possibilities to do this will arise, but we must hammer a sense of it into the heads of those who would teach our youth in the future. A sense for something else will also awaken, namely a sense of something that goes beyond specialization, something we are attempting to create through anthroposophy. We must see to it that the thread connecting us to a general consideration of what is human and to the insight into what the human being actually is never breaks. We must keep people from drowning in specialization, even though they must be good specialists. This demands a much more active life than modern people are often comfortable with. At various academic and technical conferences, I have often had an extremely unfortunate experience. People come together in these conferences with the express intention of furthering their subject, and they often do this for hours, quite diligently and zealously. However, I have frequently heard an unusual expression, namely, shop talk. People wanted only to find some time where they no longer talked shop, that is, no longer talked about their specialty. Sometimes they spoke of the dumbest things, the most boring things, but they no longer talked shop. People talked about all kinds of things, sometimes good things, but they frowned upon that. In short, people were happy when they no longer had to talk shop. That people are happy to get away from what they do and should do for humanity just illustrates how little connection they have with their work. Now I ask you, if leaders who so quickly attempt to run away from their specialities can ever understand a population so desirous of and willing to work, if you smugly talk about everything that is wrong with the working classes today, then you have not asked the working classes what created these wrongs, but instead have asked the middle-class people who created the problems and are everywhere. Those harnessed to a dying capitalism as workers cannot find a place in society where they can find happiness in their work. If those who stand above them always slip quickly out of work they should happily undertake. These are the ethical side effects of our modern pedagogy. This is what is most important to see and most important to change. A great deal exists in the thinking habits of teachers that must become quite different in the future. What did I want to discuss in this lecture? I wanted to make clear to you how radically we must present what must occur today. I wanted to present the absolute necessity that we rise above the trivia, the terrible details, into which we have forced the content of our thought and our entire life of feeling and willing. How is will to blossom? We need this will for the future, if it remains trapped in the habit of small-caliber thinking and feeling. What do we need for the future that we do not have today? We need a genuine human psychology. We need to know everything about developing human beings, but we have shut out this knowledge. Instead, we have examination methods that experiment around on people, unable to enter intuitively into human individuality. These methods purport to reveal people's capabilities, but we no longer trust ourselves to point out the discrepancies. Why? Because we lack sufficient interest in such things. Because we go through life with our souls asleep. Our souls must awaken. We must really look at things. Then we will see the absurdity of much that we honor as tremendous progress today. These poor elementary school teachers, whom we send out like tame rabbits, cannot see anything of what actually lives in the world. They raise children in the same way they pass by their fellow human beings, without the slightest idea of what lives in their souls. Quite independent of the fact that many in the middle class have no will at all to address the dominant current problems and impulses. Those who do have will are barely useful, since they have no idea what is necessary. They have completely slept through the decades when day after day the proletariat schooled itself politically. Today we seldom hear workers complaining about having too little time or being too busy when the need arises to speak about major problems in our time. They make the time. If you approach middle-class groups, they never have time to look into current problems. They all have so much to do. But this is not the real reason. They actually do not have the slightest idea how to consider such problems. They are totally unable to really tackle a problem, since no one ever taught them to do this. This is not simply a pessimistic viewpoint, nor is it meant as a tirade. I am simply stating the facts. We've experienced that where life has forced people to learn, they have learned. But where their own motivation could have led people to learn, nothing happened, nothing at all. This is why we stand in the middle of such misery today, and why we hear in everything attempted today, not only in expressions of ill will, there is certainly enough of that, but in all the other nonsense that comes simply from a lack of knowledge of life. No schools took the trouble to teach how to learn from life. Some people did trickle through the walls of comfort and reached people, but this did not happen because people were taught to confront the events of life with wide-awake senses. Those who continue to talk in the old way, who seem to have wound the clockworks of their brains and are now letting them tick, could learn much from the sad events of the present. They hold conferences today in just the same manner as before the catastrophe of this war. Great numbers of people have learned little from these terrible events because they have simply not grasped how to learn. Now, due to the suffering, they must learn what they did not learn from the frightening events of the past. Some time ago I mentioned Hermann Grimm, a quite wise and well-educated observer of life, whom I also mentioned in my book titled Toward Social Renewal. Back in the 1890s, this man said, quote, "If you look around at life and the direction in which it is rushing, namely in the direction of unrestrained armament, then you have to admit that you would like to fix a day of general suicide. Life has become so hopeless." Unquote. People wanted to live in dreams and illusions, and those who called themselves practical wanted this the most. However, today we must wake up. Those who do not wake up cannot work upon what we need so much today, what each individual human being needs so much. Many people today do not even know which end of the hammer to grab. I wanted to say this, in a sense, as the kind of discussion we should hold at today's teachers' conferences. We should develop these thoughts with the people who are to teach our youth, since they need to see what must occur. When we continue these observations, we will go further into things specific to pedagogy and education. The end of Lecture 9.